Rick Rule, President and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
A pleasure, Tom. I've enjoyed our conversations in various of your incarnations over time, so thank you for having me back.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Rick. I know I always very much look forward to our conversations, number one. Number two, I always learn something and take lots away from our conversations to think about. Of course, you're coming off, let's say, the big culmination of the last year of work, having hosted the Rick Rule Investment Conference in Boca Raton last week. So I'd like to start by getting your sense of, let's say, interesting lessons learned for you, maybe sentiment, and how the crowd has metabolized this 30% drawdown in gold and 50% in silver prices that we've seen so far.
If you're polling a Rick Rule crowd, either live or online, particularly one that has paid to be at the event, not a free crowd, and been asking them about the state of precious metals and natural resources markets, it's sort of analogous to asking an evangelical church, the choir, if they believe in God. You know, the audience self-selects. It is interesting to gauge the participants likely by the duration of their involvement in markets, how they feel about the decline. New adherents, particularly the precious metals thesis, are unnerved by a 20% decline in the gold price and a 50% decline in the silver price. Those of us who lived through the declines in the 1975 or the declines in 2012 understand that you can suffer a 20 or 30 or 50% decline, a cyclical decline in a secular bull market, and not violate the market. I think it also varied by net worth, which isn't surprising, but it wasn't a conclusion that I would have drawn before the conference. What I noticed is that the very, very wealthy participants in the crowd are inclined to save in gold. And they are inclined to want to buy more. For people who want to buy more, they welcome the price decline. I mean, I myself am a consistent gold buyer because I'm a consistent saver. When I look at the mid price point and I look at the price at which I would sell gold, it's much higher than this. So higher gold prices aren't in my interest. Because I'm a consistent buyer of gold, lower gold prices are indeed in my interest. And I think really where one sits on that divide is between people who can afford to take the long view and people who can't. And probably, dare I say so, between people who want to live rich, that is, they're speculators in gold, and those who want to be rich, who are savers in gold. That might sound pompous, and it might be pompous, but it was interesting gauging the opinions of various participants and then trying to categorize them in terms of their duration in the markets, their experience in the markets, and their aggregate net worth. A different and perhaps better gauge of sentiment would be the sentiments among the exhibitors. We talked off the air about the fact that most of the attendees on the conference probably devote less than 10% of their time and attention to markets. You know, they have lives. They have kids. They have grandkids. They have books to read, jobs to do, gardens to tend, whatever it is. The exhibitors are very different. It's existential for the exhibitors. And with the caveat that our exhibitors are very high quality, probably the best 1% of companies, 1 or 2% of public companies in these markets worldwide, there was an absolute uniform optimism, something I've seldom seen before. There is a widely advertised shortage of capital in the junior space, but it doesn't affect the best companies. Good projects finance themselves. Look at Tectonic, exploration stage, way pre-revenue, way pre-preliminary economic assessment. And they raise $90 million. for generative exploration in central Alaska. The capital dearth that the junior market is experiencing is not something that the best companies, the best people, the best projects in the company, in the country, are experiencing. There is a lot of money out there for good people and good projects. Similarly, perhaps because of the availability of capital, there is a uniform commitment to expanding exploration expenditures. The prospect generators, as an example, Tom, a generally unloved sector in the exploration business, are finding after 15 years, well, where the market for their exploration concepts they sell to other mining companies was somewhat constrained. These guys are all out of inventory. It's sort of like a supermarket that looks at the bread shelf and there's no bread on the shelf. And we're seeing that really throughout the sector. So I would suggest that the people who are more involved in the sector are oddly uniformly bullish. 5 or 6 years ago, when I, as a contrarian, noticed that the issuers were terrified, that was a wonderful sign for me. You know, I love professional capitulation. But when you look at the market sentiment, the investment intention among the issuers was very, very strong.
So, Rick, with that kind of juxtaposition where the let's say the quality companies have lots of access to capital, what do you kind of chalk that up to? Is it investors getting smarter? Is it more access to information? You know, how do we think about that?
I think 6 or 7 months ago, there were lots of newcomers in resource capital markets, and they were fairly indiscriminate about how they spent their money, but they were also momentum chasers. Mm-hmm. When silver lost a bid, as an example, their willingness to commit to precious metals took a hit. I think, and I'm making this up, but one really big source of capital for the better juniors now is the majors, the seniors. And they have figured out that they've been 2-decade-long under investors, that they need to catch up. Yep. So it isn't a question of wanting to. In their case, it's a question of needing to. But the financial markets, too, are much more specialized and much more sophisticated. 15 or 20 years ago, Orion, now a major funder, didn't exist. You know, it just didn't exist. There's a whole range of players, private equity players, private credit players, sophisticated groups. At our conference, as an example, there were at least 9 big family offices represented. The type of investor that you would not have seen at a mining conference 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So the capital markets are deeper and increasingly more sophisticated. We had a blip a year ago, you know, between sort of June of last year and January of this year, where generalist investors, momentum speculators, people, I guess, chased out of crypto or whatever, came in. But they're tourists. Their absence has been sadly noted by the 85% or so of juniors that are basically valueless. But the truth is that good projects are attracting really good capital. I remember, and this is bittersweet, I remember back at the beginning of the conference in the early 90s, if my memory serves me right, we financed Altius at 35 cents with a full warrant. They did a bought deal yesterday of 3 million shares at $61. A bought deal, not a best efforts deal. Now, it's a vastly different company now, mm-hmm. but the fact is that they were able to walk into Scotiabank and the dealers and get $3 million done at $61 firm, but tells you probably all you need to know about the capital availability to high-quality players with high-quality assets.
Mm-hmm. So, Rick, you know, I guess inherent in even a $4,000 gold price is record margins for the majors. Yep. And You know, that's something that I was thinking about this morning when I was preparing, was this idea that because of these record margins, is this, you know, a part of the mining cycle or the gold bull cycle where we start to see more M&A because of these companies' ability to generate so much cash at this time?
I would suggest that the most valuable part of the conference was, for investors, the discussion of M&A. And the answer to what you say is yes. Sidebar, without an increase in the gold price, and I'm not bullish about the gold price for the next 4 or 5 months, mm-hmm. You're going to see margins decline substantially. Last quarter, margins were established at $4,700 or $4,800 gold. This quarter's lower. There's mm-hmm. no getting around that. Two, and this is really important for your listeners to understand, inflation in consumables around mining and inflation in capital costs around building mines is not running at the CPI stated rate. Okay, costs are increasing at closer to 8 to 10% compounded than they are 2.5% compounded, mm-hmm. and that will work its way through to margin. Many of these businesses, as an example, are very energy intensive, and the much higher energy prices that we're experiencing today will show up on margins. The second thing, and we talked about this at the conference, it is likely 4 or 5 years ago during periods of lower gold prices that companies were mining grades that were substantially above their average recovered grade over the life of mine, which is a fancy way of saying they were high grading. Yeah. If they didn't report that on their balance sheet, at a unit of product basis as opposed to a tons basis, they were underreporting. In other words, they were overstating their earnings at that point in time. That comes back to haunt you. If you mine the good eyes out of the deposit, you lower your overall recoveries while raising your costs. And so we're going to catch a bit of that in the next 2 years. Margins will decline. What's important, I think, is that the emphasis of Bay Street and Wall Street for mining and oil and gas companies, for that matter, is going to change and is changing right now from capital discipline to sustainability and growth. The industry really, since 2011, 2012, has been asked, and not politely, by Wall Street and Bay Street to return capital to shareholders and to be capital efficient. When you do that for extended periods of time, you cannibalize the business. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the big mining companies today, with a couple exceptions, Agnico is an example being an exception, what you see is a pipeline-constrained industry. Yes, they are swimming in cash, and they are distributing cash to shareholders, both by way of dividends and buybacks. But if they don't begin investing that cash very quickly, they're going to impair their ability to produce 4 years from now and 5 years from now. And I think that the companies are going to be asked to exhibit sustainability and even growth, much like they were in the early part of the decade of the 2000s. When that changes, given a 10 or 15 year hiatus in investing, the companies are going to have to buy sustainability. They're going to have to buy growth. If you and I, Tom, set out to conduct grassroots exploration in a region that hadn't seen much exploration in the past, those areas that are the most likely to yield big deposits. What I found is that district scale grassroots exploration usually bears its first economic success in 10 years. Mm-hmm. So let's say we're that lucky. Let's say we go to Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan or someplace like that, Bolivia, and we invest 10 years and a bunch of money and we find a mine, heaven forbid. We'll be, after discovery, 2 or 3 years drilling that mine out. And then we'll be 2 or 3 years financing and permitting the mine. And then we'll be a couple years building the mine and a year shaking it in, which is to say, if we start today, 19 or 20 years from now, we'll be able to impact supply. The investors won't wait 19 or 20 years for grassroots exploration. They are going to buy successful efforts. So the companies that enjoy premium market valuations, which is to say higher share prices and lower cost of capital, will take over the companies that enjoy a higher cost of capital or a lower share price valuation. If value arbitrageurs like you and I don't arbitrage the value differentials out of the market, the big companies will take over the little companies. Single asset producers are always viewed by the market, justifiably, as riskier, because if something goes wrong with their one mine, they're toast for a while. Mm-hmm. You eliminate that discount when another single asset producer takes them over or a multi-asset producer takes them over. So the single asset producers with high quality assets likely get taken over. The laggards in the market that might have one good asset and two or three assets get taken over too, because the acquirer can sell the two or three second tier assets to lower the cost of acquisition of their tier one deposit. And those rare, high quality, big exploration successes will be sold for absolutely eye-popping multiples. The same phenomenon that existed in the 1998 to 2004 timeframe. So M&A is going to be important. The best M&A will be strategic. Witness Agnico Eagle taking over and consolidating districts where they can utilize the newly acquired assets to leverage the existing producing assets they have in the area. A follow-on to that, particularly in places like the Abitibi in Ontario and Quebec, is deposits that are too small to amortize their own mill that in the prior four cycles haven't gotten built. As a consequence of the expansion of infrastructure in the Abitibi, will get built this cycle because they don't have to build a mill. They build a mine and they truck the material 20K, 30K, sometimes 50K to an existing mill facility. If you take $250 or $300 million out of the upfront capital cost, some of those deposits with $500 or $600 or $700 million NPV get built because the upfront capital cost is lower. Then there's a different type of acquisition, which is to say a tactical acquisition. The merger between Orla and Equinox is one such merger. There's almost no operating synergy between their assets. But by merging these two companies, you create automatically a new major, a million-ounce producer. The larger company enjoys greater trading liquidity. They enjoy index inclusion, which means they enjoy passive ETF buying, which means they lower their cost of capital. The next 2 or 3 years, we'll see an orgy of strategic mergers and an orgy of tactical mergers. So what you said, M&A, was really, I think, the crux of the useful information in the conference. How to identify targets, how to discipline yourself as a speculator around the M&A theme. That was really, I think, where the conference was at.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much to pick up on there, Rick, and I do want to get to why you see, you know, probably softer gold prices for the next couple months here. But, you know, one of the things that inherent in what you're saying and inherent in this idea of being, let's say, a gold and or silver speculator is this idea of 85% of the juniors being basically worthless. Why are there so many worthless companies in this sector?
I've wondered that for years. I think it's because, as Warren Buffett noted, the human propensity towards gambling and hope, the propensity of humans to feel as opposed to think. Feeling is easy. And there's no shortage of very good dream weavers in the junior market. People who talk about higher gold prices as though it were a locked inevitability, and then try to convince you that as a consequence of higher gold prices, their company, which has no gold, should go up. I think, unfortunately, we've proven this, I think, in the rule classroom. In order to speculate successfully, you have to work hard. And you have to think, not feel. People don't like that. It's easier to feel. It's not easy to think. When I tell people at the conference that the number of junior mining stocks in their portfolio should correspond exactly with the number of hours per month that they're willing to work, I see very disheartened looks on their faces. There are no shortage of people. Tom, you know I've graded tens of thousands of portfolios in my time. There are no shortage of people that own 40 or 50 gold stocks or mining stocks that work 2 or 3 hours a month. Mm-hmm. That's the equivalent of Doug Casey's old joke about got a hunch, bet a bunch. It doesn't work, but I think it is responsible for the plethora of nothing nowhere juniors.
So, Rick, yesterday we got a cooler CPI print, and that sent gold and silver, as well as a good amount of the miners, up. Why is gold in this environment acting basically like a risk asset?
Well, let's deal with the first part of your statement first, the CPI. And let's deal with the theme before that, which is to say people would rather feel than think. People don't want to calculate the rate of deterioration of their own savings relative to price levels. I equate the CPI with the CP lie, which is to say that the CPI, I think, is an extraordinarily unreliable measure of the deterioration of the purchasing power of the dollar. But it's easy, so people tend to gravitate to it. I asked you in a prior interview to ask your listeners to calculate the price of the basket of goods and services that they consume in the year 2020 versus 2026, and tell me whether they believed that the purchasing power of their dollars had declined by only 2.5% compounded. Price of gasoline doubled. In the United States, the price of healthcare and health insurance doubled. Rents more than doubled. Margin debt in terms of the percentage charge doubled. And yet they say that inflation measured by the CPI is only going up 2.5%. Mm-hmm. Importantly, that index, when it's inconvenient, doesn't include food or fuel. What use to you is an index that doesn't include lunch or tax? So the first thing I should say is that people are reacting to an unreliable statistic. But the statistic that is important is the fact that higher nominal interest rates in the U.S. relative to other parts of the world make the U.S. dollar relatively more attractive than other fiat currencies. A stronger U.S. dollar and higher nominal U.S. interest rates are very hard on gold. They're hard on gold because gold is denominated in dollars, and they're hard on gold, too, because gold does well when people are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in U.S. dollar savings products. It's really important to note that, and I suspect that the U.S. dollar will continue to be relatively strong, at least for the balance of the year. I don't think that Warsh is under any particular immediate pressure to, again, artificially depress interest rates in the United States, which suggests to me that capital will continue to flow into dollars, and that for people who don't consider the CPI, which is the vast majority of humankind, that when they look at the yield available on, say, the U.S. 10-year Treasury at 4.6, they say, well, 4.6 is better than 3. Perhaps I'll save in U.S. Treasuries. If people put down feeling for a minute and thought, then they would discover that getting paid 4.6 in a currency that's depreciating at 8% a year isn't making 4.6. It's losing 3.5. Mm-hmm. And if you lose 3.5 a year for 10 years, you have lent the U.S. government $100,000 and they've given you back $50,000 or $55,000 in purchasing power. But most people prefer to feel than to think. And I suggest that that dichotomy will continue for most of the next 6 months. Your older listeners, and I'm sure you have some, will remember the period 1968 to 1972 when inflation was on the wall. But investors' expectation of the future was set by their experience in the immediate past. And the 1950s and the 1960s were very good times mm-hmm. for investors. So people weren't afraid of inflation until experiencing 5 years of it in their household expense relative to their paycheck caused them to wake up vigorously in 1972. And I suspect there is a vigorous wake up in our future, Tom, for the same reasons.
So, Rick, you know, I've obviously interviewed many people in not only the precious metal space, but also kind of, let's say, the investing space. And I've interviewed several who I would consider thinking people that are suggesting that T-bills and bonds are a great place to be right now. Why is that? Despite this seemingly relatively easy calculus of losing money on an absolute basis.
I can only think that either they buy a different basket of services than I, one not including food or fuel, or that while they're good at narrative, they're bad at math. It's very difficult for me to understand how getting paid 4.6 in a currency that's depreciating at 8 is a good idea, unless you're a trader. If you own the 30-year bond and war forces down the interest rate at the end of the year, you made a large capital gain. Trading bonds is not the same as a store of value or maintenance of your purchasing power. So perhaps it depends on your duration, or perhaps it depends on your intention. I'm not a bond trader. The idea that I would look for capital gains in a bond, in a fixed income instrument, rather than in a business that could grow, feels to me akin to bending over in front of a steamroller to pick up quarters. You know, it's not an activity that I want to engage in. But anybody who defends owning the long bond or attempting to maintain purchasing power in fiat-denominated instruments, I think is deficient both in arithmetic and history.
On the other side of this, Rick, you know, there are many cheerleaders within this space as well. You know, if you think about the idea of talking to a CEO, for example, that has an incentive to create interest in his company, how do we try to mitigate the emotional manipulation from the cheerleaders in the precious metal space?
Thank you for the opportunity for a commercial. I think the first place you go is the Rule Classroom, which is free. 300 and something hours of instructional programming, including, I think, 5 hours on introduction to natural resource investing, which tells you specifically how you interrogate a mining company CEO and how you do rudimentary fundamental analysis so that you have to care less about their narrative. I'm always concerned myself, Tom, when a CEO who's trained, say, as a geologist starts to lecture me on global macro and gold, particularly in the exploration stage where they have no gold, trying to convince me that if the price of something they don't have any of goes up, that it should impact their intrinsic value. We started this interview by saying at a minimum, 85% of the companies in the space are valueless. What that means is that the speculator, your listener, should invest in himself or herself in their education before they invest in these stocks. The ability to do that at the Rule Classroom and other places is free, but you have to do it. You have to invest in yourself. This is not a sector, even in a bull market, that is characterized by easy money. I guess at age 73, I've learned there's no such thing as easy money, but there is such a thing as sure money. The sure money comes to those who do the work and don't believe in easy money.
I think that's a really important lesson, and also something that you're working to not only point people towards the Rural Classroom, but you're also working to create a portfolio for people that are interested to kind of follow along as well, right?
Sure. I mean, if you're referring to the Rural newsletter, absolutely. You know, I think that we've published a free newsletter for a couple of years, 28,000 subscribers. We're rolling out a paid version of that. And in that paid version, unlike any other newsletter I know, we'll have a real account with real money, mine. And what that letter will be all about is exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. If the lawyers allow us to, the premium part of that service will see us emailing trade tickets to subscribers as soon as they're full. so you can see what we do and why in real time. Now, that's no substitute for doing the work yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm managing my money, not yours. So what you need to do is prepare yourself so that you can use my rational sense and my methodology, but you can impose your own values, your own risk tolerance, your own time preference, because it's important for your people to remember, which they sometimes forget, they are the only real true stewards of their capital. They need to take ownership of capital allocation. What I can do is suggest techniques, even name names, mm-hmm. but it's important that your listeners take control of the future. I get asked all the time, is thus and such or so and so better? Well, what does better mean? If there's 8.3 billion people on Earth, there's 8.3 billion different parameters. There are very few one-size-fits-all answers. And the best judge, ultimately, of what answer is right for you is you, once you've spent the time to understand the question.
Well, taking action is something that I've spoken about quite a bit on this channel. And, you know, the idea of educating yourself in order to be able to take proper action is, as you say, it's difficult because you have to do the work, right?
Right. Let's talk about a couple of easy screens just for fun. You, Tom, have heard me discuss Pareto's Law a lot, but mm-hmm. perhaps the current listeners haven't. Pareto's Law is a social science dictum around the 80-20 rule, the sense that 20% of the population does 80% of the work. Turns out, in many disciplines, that's true. What many people don't realize, and many people don't like it because it's inherently an elitist concept. It just happens to be true, whether or not we like it. What's maybe more interesting for investors is that it's a bell curve, a bell-shaped curve. And that suggests to you that 20% of the population generates 80% of the positive utility, and a different 20% of the population generates 80% of the aggravation or disutility. Your first job as an investor is to hang out with the good 20 and avoid the bad 20. Mm-hmm. But it gets easier, actually. If you take that good lip or the bad lip, the 20% that are serial outperformers in a positive or negative sense, and you run them through an identical performance dispersal curve, what you'll see is that they conformably align, meaning that 20% of the 20 does 80% of the 80, or 4% of the population generates 65% of the utility. And I found after 50 years in extractive industries that the data conformably aligns at least one more time, which is to say that 1% of the population generates 40% of the utility. So the first screen that a speculator who's a listener of yours can make is, are they hanging out with, are their managements part of the 1%? Are they part of the serially successful people who deliver success after success after success? And importantly, is their task reasonably related to the task at hand? Now, that's an important question, because somebody who describes himself or herself as a success in mining, where that success was operating a gold mine in 2-billion-year-old Archean terrain in French-speaking Quebec, but the task at hand is exploring rather than producing for copper-gold porphyries in 15-million-year-old accreted terrain in Spanish-speaking Peru, the success is not necessarily germane to the task at hand. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that the first screen that your listeners employ in the quest for investment success in junior mining stocks is the track record of the senior management team, including the chairman, relative to the task at hand. That one screening technique will probably eliminate 60 or 65% of your failures. That one. Mm-hmm. The second screening technique, when you talk to the IR person, or better yet, the CEO, in an exploration stage company or a development stage company is you ask them, what is the single most important unanswered question that you and the market have concerning your assets? What can you do that will increase the confidence of the market in terms of knowledge of the value of your asset? And how do you propose to test the thesis? How long will the test take? And how much will the test cost? I'm disgusted to say, in 40 years of asking those questions, about 80% of the executives that I've asked the question to have said to me, you know, I've never thought of it in that sense. It's very difficult to get someplace if you don't know where it is and you don't have a plan. If they do have a plan, it's important that you know how long it will take. If it's going to take a yes answer to change the value as opposed to the price of your stock, let's say it's going to take 18 months to answer the unanswered question. That means you as a speculator have to be prepared to own the stock for 18 months. Mm-hmm. If tactically your time preference is over a long weekend, it's unlikely that you will own the stock long enough to experience the gain that you're hoping for. And then there's the reality question. What will the test cost? Oh, it's going to cost $5 million plus $2 million in G&A. That's $7 million. How much money do you have? Three. Well, if it's going to cost you seven and you have three, how are you going to afford to get me a yes answer? It's okay if they say I have to raise the money. Then you say, how do I know you can? Who can you raise it from? And may I have their phone number to confirm that you have access to that money? These are really simple things, mm-hmm. and they aren't going to give you by themselves success, but they are going to allow you to avoid failure.
Rick, in this space, there's different ways, not only for people to invest, but there's also different ways for companies to access capital.
Yep.
Private placements are a big part of how this industry has that access to capital.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Is there, you know, if you're not an accredited investor, let's say, is there any point in investing in this space?
Oh, I think so. I'm on strike as an accredited investor right now because capital is so available for the higher quality companies that none of them will give me warrants. Mm-hmm. The idea that I would buy restricted stock, particularly as an American, where my restriction is often 12 months as opposed to four, without them giving me a warrant, I'm just not interested. I'm much more frequently now an on-market buyer than I am a private placement buyer, and I will remain an on-market buyer until the issuers are forced once again to give me warrants. I'm 73 years of age. That may be I'm an on-market investor for the rest of my life.
Rick, I want to go back to this idea of why you think there's more downside, basically, in the metals prices and just make it a little bit more explicit. Is a good amount of it due to basically the uncertainty around what we're facing, not only from a, let's say, a Fed perspective, but also a war perspective?
I don't think the war has much to do with it on a going forward basis. I do think that the war and higher energy prices acted as a tax. It took a lot of liquidity out of the economy. Mm-hmm. All taxes are bad, Tom, as I believe you know. And I think that there is a staggered effect. In other words, I think that we're going to feel the effect of illiquidity more in the second half of the year than we did in the first half of the year. I think that global economic activity is going to be slower than people expect. And the consequence of that will be marginally less demand for stuff like copper. I also think that interest rates that are higher than they normally have been will raise the cost of maintaining natural resources, particularly copper and oil, in inventory. Mm-hmm. So the speculators who have usually provided the buffer stocks for the industry will be inclined to dishoard because their interest costs are going up. But I think the primary competition will be higher interest rates, a stronger U.S. dollar. And as a consequence of that, more interest in fixed income products and simply a weaker quote for dollar denominated goods, including the Canadian dollar.
So, Rick, as we think about how to, let's say, how to build a portfolio, obviously, you and I are very interested in many of the natural resources.
Right.
Because of your informational advantage that basically constrains you a lot to this natural resource sector, do you think of that as being, as building a diversified portfolio?
I don't. And I question now the benefit of diversification for an intelligent investor. Warren Buffett, who did a pretty good job for a long time, said his preference would have been to put all his eggs in one basket and watch that basket extraordinarily closely. Now, he was smarter than I, is smarter than I. So he has the ability with his staff to see in all industries. There was a point in time when, as a young man, I had been successful in resources, and I thought the consequence of that was that I was a good investor. And I began to invest across many different industries. And as often as not, I got punished, not because I didn't work hard, but because I didn't have the same knowledge basis in those industries. So I now invest in natural resources, and I invest in conventional financial services. You know, I've built banks, I've built insurance companies, I've built wealth managers and asset managers. So I understand those two businesses. And I have much less interest in investing outside my circle of competence. I also believe that with regards to natural resources, that humankind has underinvested in productive capacity for 30 years. And the next 10 years will be pretty good. There will come a time, and hopefully I'll be cognizant of it, when the market works, which is to say when resource prices and resource equities are high enough that they no longer offer good value. And I have no idea what I'll do then. If we dial back to the decade of the 1970s, by the end of that decade, 1980, 1981, 1982, interest rate sensitive investments like bonds, like utilities, were extremely cheap. And perhaps that'll happen again. Perhaps you'll have a sideways move from gold to anti-gold, which is to say, perhaps the 30-year U.S. Treasury, if it's yielding 16 or 17%, will be a good relative investment. I remember in 1982 seeing San Jose Waterworks, the most boring utility on the planet, yielding 13 in an environment where high interest rates had broken inflationary expectation. So who knows what opportunity will be available for me at the end of the resource bull market. But I fully intend to play that market until the time comes. In the other side of my life, when I look at general equities markets, I don't know how to assess a consumer durables market or a retail. I do know how to assess financial services businesses. And I look at some of the smaller community banks in the U.S., there's about 4,000 of them. And I see a variety of businesses that are cheap. I don't mean kind of cheap. I mean businesses that have yielded 10 or 12% after tax. When I say yielded, earned 10 or 12% after tax on book, that are selling at 60% of book, which means that I'm getting a 15% after tax earnings yield. And in a circumstance right now, often that money can be reinvested back into the same business at the same high real rates of return. That seems very attractive to me. You have to know enough to do the work. But after, you know, 50 years of learning, I am able to do it. And I would suspect that if your listeners, the length and breadth of them, applied themselves to investing topics that they understood, and if they spent 6 months making themselves better fundamental investors, that there's a plethora of opportunities out there available for those who are willing to think as opposed to feel, and available for those who are willing to work.
Rick, you know, this time and this, let's say this year already, we've seen a lot of volatility, a lot of different things happen in the world. As somebody that does have a lot of experience within the energy sector, do you expect to see this energy shock that was somewhat mitigated by SPR releases, China cutting imports, and basically just this crazy market? Do you expect to see that kind of come to a head here in the latter part of the year as well?
No. But it's a really important question. Mm-hmm. When you and I talked last year about oil and gas, what I talked about was an impending structural shortage that would cause oil to be rationed by price. I didn't know or think there was going to be a war. Mm-hmm. But the war was instructive. In the face of anticipation of a shortage rather than the experience of a shortage, mm-hmm. we saw oil prices go from $55 to $115. We had sufficient floating inventories and sufficient reserves in many countries so that we never experienced a real oil shortage. In North America, we experienced no shortage whatsoever. In countries that couldn't afford a buffer, Sri Lanka, you know, Bangladesh, Myanmar, they experienced a real shortage because they couldn't afford the cargoes. But we didn't. The consequence, though, of at least two, maybe 2.5 years of systemic underinvestment in sustaining capital in the oil and business, which continues to today, means that the next shortage that we experience will be structural rather than artificial. Mm-hmm. I suspect this happens towards the end of 2029. We are underinvesting at least $1 billion a day in sustaining capital investments. And that need was exacerbated during the war. Iran obviously wasn't investing in sustaining capital because they didn't have any money. And because we'd blow the stuff up as soon as they built it. The same with Qatar and the Emirates, and to a lesser degree, Saudi. And now, in addition to this deferred sustaining capital investment, we need to rebuild all the stuff that got blown up. The next shortage that we face won't be a shortage occasioned by a conflict in the Straits of Hormuz, and it won't be able to be ended with an armistice. It'll be a consequence of $2.5 or $3 trillion in deferred sustaining capital investments. And the only way that you can make up for that is an investment of $2.5 or $3 trillion new dollars. And that will take time. Mm-hmm. I think the price lesson that we learned is instructive. I think the fact that the threat of shortage doubled the oil price should cause people to wonder what will happen with the reality of a shortage, but a shortage that can't be fixed with an armistice. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we'll experience in 2029 or 2030. Mm-hmm. Investors have been underinvesting in oil for a very long time because of a widely held premise that's wrong. The big thinkers of the world, the Angela Merkels and the Justin Trudeaus and the Greta Thunbergs of the world, would have us believe that peak oil demand will occur in 2030, except it won't. I'm 73 years of age. Peak oil demand won't happen in my lifetime, and it might not happen in your lifetime. And the consequence of that is that the valuations that we put in oil stocks, as though their business ends in 2030, is very, very, very wrong. And the underinvestment that has occurred as a consequence of this undervaluation is something that will bite us in 2029, 2030. It will bite us as consumers. It will be very friendly to us as investors. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems, Rick, that underinvestment occurs in basically all of the natural resources. So,
right. The reason I point out oil is it's such a big business and it's such a good business that the undercurrents, the quality of the businesses that you can buy as an investor to avail yourself of this circumstance are so good that I can talk about it with a straight face to an audience as large as yours and know I'm doing no harm whatsoever. If I were to talk about smaller markets with lower quality companies, some of your subscribers could get the macro theme wrong, get the macro theme right, get the micro theme wrong, and still lose money. Mm-hmm. I have no difficulty talking to your audience about the Exxons of the world, or in terms of smaller companies, Canadian companies, the freehold royalties of the world. No hesitancy whatsoever, because the businesses are such high quality businesses, and the business itself, the energy business, is so gigantic.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of that, does this really make you bullish as well on uranium and this the nuclear power, in some ways, renaissance that we have seen over the last couple of years as part of this demand for more and more and more energy over the world?
Yes. And importantly, the conflict in the Straits of Hormuz changed that to the benefit of uranium. Let me explain. It was the Arab oil embargo in 1973 that in the modern time was the first cause of concern around energy security. The French nuclear fleet, now the fourth largest in the world, was constructed as a consequence of the Arab oil embargo. The Japanese nuclear fleet, the third largest in the world, was also constructed as a consequence of the Arab oil embargo. Uranium is the only fuel that's dense enough that a warehouse can contain all the energy needed to power France or Japan for 5 years. Mm-hmm. We went 50 some odd years unconcerned about energy security, but the conflict in the Straits of Hormuz ended all of that in a 2 or 3 month time frame. The wind was already blowing towards uranium. Mm-hmm. Public opinion in Japan, which was 70% opposed, is now 70% in favor. In my own country, the United States, I felt as a proponent of nuclear energy that I would find my picture in a post office wall, and not in a good sense. And now those same morons want to subsidize me. I felt cleaner when I was vilified than subsidized, but you get the point. Uranium is the only substance that can generate reliable baseload power 24/7 and do so without generating carbon, mm-hmm. an important factor for many people today. It's also, in a less well-known sense, the only commodity on the planet where increasingly pricing is governed by contracts rather than the spot market. So a new producer or an established producer can enter into supply arrangements with a credit, with an investment credit grade utility, and lock in prices and quantities for 10 or 15 years. That means that you can, as an investor, invest in companies without having to make price assumptions that you don't know enough to make. Mm-hmm. That plus this newfound sense of energy security means that, well, for sure, the easy money has been made in uranium. The certain money is ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And at age 63, there's a 73, pardon me. There's something about certainty that I've come to enjoy.
Well, I would think that that sense of certainty also comes from the ability to build your own bank now, to be able to have, you know, let's say design that financial system the way that you want it to inspire confidence and to reward people that are utilizing that instrument as well.
That's more about creating certainty for other people. I'm a pretty good bank company customer, and I have certainty now because I understand the business. What Battle Bank is all about is passing that certainty on to other people, making sure that by conventional standards, the bank has too much equity. Banking is a leveraged business, and too many managers try to drive that leverage to the nth degree. I don't want to do that. I want to trade solvency for margin. Certainty is also a management team that doesn't try to be all things to all people. Great big banks like the Bank of America or the Royal Bank of Canada attempt to lend to 500 industries. Well, I will grant you that they're substantially smarter than me. They're not smart enough to lend to 500 industries without experiencing occasional catastrophic failure. Witness 2008. Our bank is going to lend to industries that we know extremely well. There's a different kind of certainty. The big banks typically have 10 to 20 deposit products. The only reason you have 10 to 20 deposit products is to fool people. Battle Bank has certainty. We have one deposit product, a high-yield money market fund that you can write checks against. In the United States, there's $3 trillion on deposit that earns no interest. Speaking of certainty, that's certainly stupid. If you're interested in certainty, if you're interested in interest, you don't need 15 deposits, five of which don't pay you interest. You need one that does. We give people some flexibility in the sense that we allow you to save in 20 currencies. You can save in Canadian dollars or Australian dollars. You can save in euros, in the Swiss franc, so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. I would say one of the important differences between Battle Bank and other banks is that we service this community. And that is exemplified by the fact that we encourage people to save in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, but particularly gold. And for those investors who've been prudent enough to do so, but need periodically to access the capital that they have tied up in their stack, we'll lend against their stack. You don't have to borrow the money. You have a credit line, so you take it down when you need it. You don't have to pay me interest if you don't need the money. But let's say you have a stack of gold and silver, and the opportunity comes up to buy a duplex in a distressed sale in your neighborhood, and you need the down payment without selling your stack and paying the capital gains tax. At Battle Bank, we believe you, if you're prudent enough to save in gold, and your gold have value, and we will lend against that. The great big banks will do it too. With $10 million minimums. We'll do it with a $100,000 minimum.
Rick, I've seen that there's, let's say, a financial strategy where people lend or borrow against their stocks, their resource, whatever it is, their resource stocks, anything like that. Is that something that you guys do or that you have seen as well?
We don't do conventional margin lending. The brokerage firms do a reasonable job of that. Some firms, the really aggressive ones, the Canaccords of the world, the Haywoods of the world, will actually lend against penny stocks. I'm not of a habit of lending to speculators. It's as though I was lending to drunks in a bar. It's just not my idea of a good time. But allowing people to access capital secured by gold, silver, platinum, and palladium is an entirely different business. I'm not suggesting that margin lending on stocks is bad. I'm just suggesting that it is for a disciplined professional investor and prudently would involve stocks that are less volatile than, non-producing mineral exploration companies, trying to be polite.
So Rick, going back to, the lessons learned from the conference, I had the pleasure of attending 2 years ago. I wasn't able to make it this year, but I found an absolute treasure trove of information in the recorded information and videos, all of the presentations afterwards. I was able to review it for quite a while. Is that the same with this year?
Yeah, Tom. I mean, I was there. I put on the conference, and I'm going to have to play the recordings. It was frustrating. There were so many things for me to do at once that I didn't get to enjoy my own conference. In particular, most days there were five breakout sessions occurring simultaneously. So how could you want be five places at one time? The consequence of that is that anybody who came to the conference live or live stream has access to the recordings, and people who didn't come to the conference can buy the recordings too. much of the information is timeless. Much of the information is how you make yourself a better investor. To be sure, a lot of information was about the M&A cycle, but that's going to be going on for 3 years, not 3 hours. If you attended live or live stream, or if you buy the tapes after the fact, what should give you some confidence is the fact that your purchase comes with a solid gold money-back guarantee. If you attended the conference, or if you didn't attend the conference and you attend it retroactively with the recordings, and you think for any reason whatsoever, and you are the determinant, if you think you didn't get your money's worth, I'll give you your money back. Now, we've been doing this 31 years, I'm told. Began the conference in 1995. We've had a money-back guarantee every year, and we have a money-back guarantee in all of our educational products. And I'm delighted to say in 31 years of money-back guarantees, we've had to refund a little less than 0.1% of the tuitions that we've charged. But there is no other purveyor of investment education that I know of that has an absolutely unconditional money-back guarantee. The financial risk in this transaction is all mine.
Well, for those that are interested, we'll have a link in the show notes to that. And I guess in closing, I need to ask, did you have to forfeit your own best speaker of the conference again to Grant Williams?
We haven't looked at the conference polls. That's an inside joke that your listeners might not get. One conference presenter for years, Grant Williams, has more years than not beat me as best speaker at my own conference. A couple of years ago, I finished third to Grant Williams and Robert Friedland. Unfortunately for the conference, but mercifully for me, Robert didn't speak this year. So if I get beaten by anybody, it will likely be Grant. I thought I'd give a very credible performance this year, and I didn't have the opportunity to hear Grant. This Saturday, playing the tapes, I'll decide whether I vote for me or for Grant.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, because I know Grant has put together some incredible speeches in the past.
He's just superb. And, you know, as a conference presenter, I'm delighted when other speakers outcompete me.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations again on putting together such an interesting and worthwhile experience. I know you and I were speaking before that you told me, and I read this morning, that this is finally the culmination and the community that you have wanted to attract for 31 years. So that's got to be a
great deal. Absolutely true. And it will come through on the tapes. This audience, well over half the audience attend the Rule Classroom, which is to say that they've already invested in their time and education. What has begun to occur is that the audience self-organized. They put together what I guess in the old West would have been called posses, groups of investors that did things like at different times asking the exhibitors the same question two or three times and making sure that the answers tracked. And they formed posses based on their expertise, you know, a geologist, a financial guy, that sort of thing. And then they organized posses to make sure that they covered all of the exhibitors. They'd assign one person to the team, 10 or 12 companies, and then at the end they would compare notes, which is to say that the attendees this year were not passive. They were active, and it was just absolutely wonderful to see that. The other thing that was wonderful to see over time is attendees that now go on vacation together, that study together. At the pool, you saw love festivals, basically, of exhibitors with attendees that had become shareholders in prior years that discovered that in addition to investing together, they like to hang out at the pool and drink beer together. I mean, a wonderful, wonderful sense of community, which is really what a good conference is.
Well, Rick, in wrapping up here, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we do?
A couple things. If you like what I have to say about natural resources, you can get a whole bunch of it for free. If you go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, I will rank your natural resource portfolio, and I'll do it for free. Simply submit it. List the stocks that you own, not 100 stocks that you might want to buy someday. Actually, the stocks that you own. Please no crypto. Please no pot stocks. Go to Rural Investment Media, list them, and I'll rank them absolutely for free. And take a look at the Rural Classroom. Over 300 hours of instructional programming, including the short course Introduction to Natural Resource Investing, all free. Invest in yourself before you invest in the stocks. For those of you who are serious about your portfolio, buy the recordings of the Rural Conference. Remember, the financial risk is all mine. We have enough confidence in our content that, unlike any other investor education source in the world that I know of, you have an unconditional money-back guarantee. You can't get better than that. The only no-risk transaction out there.
Excellent. Rick, a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir.